You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Studs Terkel is 95 years old. He was born 3 weeks after the sinking of the Titanic, was in Chicago during the Roaring Twenties, lived through the Depression and World War II, witnessed the golden age of radio, the advent of television, and survived being blacklisted in the McCarthy era. He's written a new memoir called Touch and Go. It's published by the New Press, and I'm pleased that it brings Studs Terkel back to the show. Hi, Studs.
Oh, Leonard Lopate. Long time. So delightful to hear from you.
Does this book pick up where your memoir of 30 years ago, Talking to Myself, a Memoir of My Times, left off?
To some extent. But so much has happened during those 30 years, I thought I'd recreate some moments. When I was 8 years old, we left New York. My father was a tailor whose heart was failing. And he died in his 50s, along with my two brothers, who died in their 50s. And here I am, 95, thanks to the advances in medicine, thanks to the advances in heart especially. And it's that same species that invented these cures that has given us Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So really it's our decision. I mean everybody's decision to see that we remember a past, good and bad, because we're living without a past. We're living some of the horrendous moments of the Cold War and earlier. So one of my themes has been to bridge this gap between the past and present.
Because you say Americans have amnesia.
Well, that's the phrase of Gore Vidal, the United States of Amnesia. And he's on the button. I go a step further. We have the United States of Alzheimer's. Not that we don't know. We've been denied our own history. The role of ordinary people has been dismissed. For example, in 1800, which was 11 years after the French Revolution, there was an election. That was a key moment in history when Thomas Jefferson beat John Adams. And the issue was the Alien and Sedition Acts. And today we have it again in the anti-immigration movement, in the tapping of the telephone. There's the Cold War stuff.
Well, is that...
I'm sorry.
No, well, is that because Americans have forgotten or simply because certain things keep on recurring throughout history? Does it really matter whether young people know more about Britney Spears than they do about Frederick Douglass when it comes to matters like the Alien and Sedition Act and the Patriot Act?
Well, that's the point. It's not they don't know. We've been denied our history, except for occasional historians like Eric Foner or Howard Zinn. A history of human beings themselves. For example, I am here because of the advances in medicine. I had the same heart difficulties as my two brothers and father, who died in their 50s. Here I am living 45 years later. At the same time, we have the same human race, Mark Twain calls the damn human race, has given us Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So the big change, basically, is technology. So absence of history now is tenfold more serious than it was, say, 100 years ago.
So you're not just thinking about...
I'm sorry.
You're not just thinking about your own mortality. You're thinking about everyone's mortality because the title of the book, Touch and Go, comes from a Dylan Thomas poem, doesn't it? And
it
every
is.
Evening... Oh, you want to say it?
Yes, it's the old preacher at the end. It's a Welsh village about their lives beginnings and sleep. And the old preacher says, each evening at sundown, I offer a blessing on this town. Whether we last the night or no, it's always touch and go. And that's what it basically is. So out of touch and go, let us touch, if I may pun, before we go. And that's the point, to be touched and to do something about it. See, one of the secrets I reveal, I'm known as the poet of the tape recorder, as I'm absolutely helpless, inept when it comes to mechanical things. I can't drive a car. I can't ride a bike. And I don't know how to operate a tape recorder. So I'm at this woman's house. It's a public housing project. Her little kids are running about. She's had fifth grade education. And I pressed the button, and I said, we'll talk. She says, sir, you've pressed the wrong button. It's not working. At that moment, everything changed. I needed her. She didn't need me. She became more than my equal. She became my mentor at that moment. That is the key. She counted. To count is the single most important thing there is. And so from that moment on, I realized that my ineptitude was my strength. And so toward the end, I pressed the right button, thanks to her. Toward the end, after she hears her voice for the first time in her life, she puts her hand to her mouth and says, oh, my God. And I said, what is it? She says, I never knew I felt that way before. Hmm. Bingo. That was bingo for both of us. That's the stuff. So sometimes my own life is touch and go.
You write in the book that I have, after a fashion, been celebrated for having celebrated the lives of the uncelebrated among us, for lending voice to the face in the crowd. So is that, in your opinion, your most important contribution to the world? Or what about all the incredible people you've met over the years, like Martin Luther King Jr. and Dorothy Parker and Tennessee Williams, Billie Holiday, Woody Guthrie, Louis Armstrong, Bob Dylan? There were so many.
Well, there it is. I treat them as I treat the others. What is their strengths? What do they contribute? Billie Holiday, for example, I've interviewed her several times, and always she spoke of continuity. She spoke of Miss Bessie, meaning Bessie Smith, who she met, who influenced her, and Billie influenced others. There's a continuity. So one day, there's a girl named Rose Rigsby, a tough kid on the block of German-American ancestry. Rose was rough. She organized a clan including black kids. And she was arrested so many times and put into the Audie home, which is a home for delinquent young. She was called the deaconess of the home. Rose had a certain poetic quality. As she's telling her friend, do not be like I am, a fat zero in the eyes of God. There was a poet in her. So Rose became a key figure to me, as well as Billy. But one day, I get a phone call from a guy who runs a motel near the airport and says, he calls me in the morning. Says, I'm a fan of yours, Studs. That's why I'm calling you. Is your wife listening? I said, that's okay. What is it? Well, there was a party here last night, a shambles. Three Texans and three young women were here, and the place is shambles, but don't worry about that. Is sure your wife's not listening? I says, no, Tony. Well, there's your name in lipstick and your phone number. I knew immediately it was Rose. And so my wife goes to work. She was a social worker at the time. At the noon, there stand three girls. My wife's so disheveled, so worn down. It was Rose, of course. And she calls them in and offers them tea or water or a Coke. And their breath is 100 proof. Now, what is she going to do with these three kids? Suddenly, she thinks of Billie Holiday, whom she admired. My wife, by the way, was petite and dancer-like. And she put a flower in her hair. Says, this is what she wore, a gardenia in her hair. And she puts on the record, fine and mellow. And she does a Billie Holiday thing. The girls were transfixed by it. And later on, I asked Nelson Algren, the novelist who played a real role in my life. And she said, they never heard stories told to them before. So that was Rose Rigsby. Later on, she became a paralegal at Cook County Jail, the most beloved they ever had, because she knew their feeling. And when she was died, you know she died? There was a gun in the house. Her drunken brother and his girlfriend had a fight, and Rose came over to settle it, and the gun went off, and Rose died. So much for the National Rifle Association, the presence of a gun. We know far more often people are killed accidentally than deliberately. So,
well, talking about guns, you recall being perched on your father's shoulders on the steps of the New York Public Library during the Armistice Day parade in 1918. Did it feel like the United States has just gone through the war to end all wars?
Well, I was a kid. My father was holding me on his shoulder and shifting me to the other shoulder, because obviously I weighed 16 tons. Damn, it was his heart. And I saw them go by, over there, and we'll do it again. And George M. Cohen and all that baloney and Bourgeois. It was a great moment. And then came Harding and normalcy, the jazz age. All this was part I remember as a kid. And then came the war. Many of the kids think, if you would analyze World War II and our thoughts, they know U.S. had Britain as its ally. But the word Soviet Union, Stalin or not, killed more Germans on the Eastern Front than any other country. 4 to 5 were scared. You saw that in a great film, The Sorrow and the Pity. And so there's a lack of history. And there's so much richness to a history, as well as so much horror, because we are human beings. Now, which decision do we make? We don't have enough for health insurance, national health insurance, we're told. We are the richest country in the world, yet as far as industrial countries are concerned, the weakest. Why? Because trillions, multi-millions, go into a crazy, phony Iraq war that we know is based upon an outrageous lie. And still we say, if you criticize it, you hurt your soldiers. On the contrary, you save more lives. Why not declare victory and go home? Which was suggestion by a New England senator toward the end of the Vietnam War.
Studs, I have to take a little break here. We'll come back with more. Studs Terkel has written a new memoir called Touch and Go. It's published by the New Press. Stay with us. We're back with Studs Terkel, the broadcaster and best-selling author of 12 books of oral history, including Working, Hard Times, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning The Good War. He is currently the distinguished scholar in residence at the Chicago Historical Society, and he's written another memoir, this one called Touch and Go, which is published by the New Press, and it's a kind of dialogue between the past and the present, isn't it? You're using your memories of the past to also talk about how things have developed in recent years.
Absolutely. It's using a personal memory, my own growing up and gradually becoming an activist. And through it all, we've gone through this period. After World War II came hysteria, came the Cold War, came the FBI, which has a very funny story itself. And then came the 60s, and there was a real revolution. By the way, that was not, World War II was not the greatest generation. A greater one was the 60s, when the young at that time challenged the phonies, HUAC, and all the Cold Warriors. And out of the 60s came a resurgence of feminism, of the civil rights movement, of the gay lesbian movement. So to me, that was an even greater generation. And then came Reagan and Reagan Democrats, and that changed, altered the entire setup. You know, there's a recent poll taken as to who our favorite president was, and they named Lincoln and Washington and Jefferson and Roosevelt. Do you know who won? Ronnie Reagan, which gives you an idea. His first act, major act, in 1981 was breaking the air controllers strike, and 80% of America applauded Ronnie. You know what that strike was about? It wasn't about pay. It was about R&R, rest and recreation. We were told every day of near misses. We were told every day that in the hands of the air controller is the fate of thousands of passengers. They were campaigning, striking for passenger safety, rest and recreation, nervous treatment, sanitaria, counseling to make them stronger. Can it be that we are a necrophilic nation, that we caught disaster? I don't believe that. It was a case of a campaign, of a buildup. And that's when things took a turn to the right. And ever since then, even the word liberal, the use of words, the word liberal has become something you deny in some quarters. As you did years ago in the Cold War, you say, I'm not a communist, but I think it's wrong to hang a guy because his skin is darker than mine. Today you say, even John Kerry said at one point, I'm not a liberal, but he was one of the officers I had as a guest once, opposed to the Vietnam War, and he was great. But in the debate, he fell for it. And so that's the way we use our phrase. That's why I call myself a radical conservative. What do you mean? I mean I'm a radical conservative. Look up the word radical. Aside from extremism, it says getting at the root of things. Louis Pasteur was a radical who saw that in a healthy drink, milk, something poisonous, and so pasteurization took place. He was called a nut, but millions of lives were saved. Semmelweis, the doctor, said, "Wash your hands." That was a radical phrase used for all workers in health.
My guess.
They say, now I'm a conservative, and I want to conserve the air to be unpolluted so that we and the kids need not get asthma. I want to conserve potable drinking water out of the tap. I want to conserve the First Amendment to the Bill of Rights. And most of all, I want to conserve what little sanity we have left. I use this phrase as a mockery of other phrases like neoliberal, neoconservative, and the kindergarten battles. As the world's fate is at stake, as Al Gore, our Nobel Prize winner this year, determined.
Studs Terkel's latest book is a memoir called Touch and Go. It's published by the New Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. At least one of the candidates running for president this year doesn't believe in evolution, and you write about remembering listening to Clarence Darrow and William Jennings Bryan argue at the Scopes trial on Chicago's WGN. I didn't even know that that was broadcast. Was the country riveted by the trial?
I'll never forget that. We miss him again. It was a crystal set before Atwater, Kent, and Zenith, and Tubes. And my father and I shared the bed together because he was ill. And we fooled around with a little wire, and we got WGN, and caught it partly, the voice of Darrow, the voice of Bryan, and the trial of young Dr. Scopes. I interviewed John Scopes years later, a middle-aged man is. I never knew I was still alive. And so there it was. The tragedy was William Jennings Bryan. He was a populist congressman from Nebraska, the boy orator, who was fantastic. He was anti-corporate, pro-small farmer, pro-national health. He was everything you'd want, except that he was a wild, literal fundamentalist who took the Bible literally. His was the great tragedy. He was one for the phrase, do not press against labor the crown of thorns, and do not crucify man on a cross of gold.
He was a pro-silver guy.
The Coliseum in Chicago went crazy with his orator. What killed him, and it did kill him, was the Scopes trial. The irony is, those same people invited me, a teacher did, to a town called Girard, Pennsylvania, near Erie, a working-class town, much unemployment. And here is the enemy, those opposed, coming down. It was like a carnival. It was jammed. And here's the enemy coming in, the fundamentalists who opposed the book. And I see an old woman, her hands are gnarled with work, and her husband studying his knuckles, all broken. And their kid, who's gone crazy, throwing all the biblical quotes at me. At one moment, she says, it wasn't at all a brigade. It was a logger. It's like they were in a covered wagon protecting themselves. And I felt so bad for them. I knew I'd win the battle. It was obvious. Author defends book. L.A. Times ripped them. Pittsburgh Gazette ripped them, and I felt horrible because that woman in her, the fundamentalist we're worried about, religious right, can be reached. There was a circuit rider named Claude Williams. A circuit rider is someone who is a preacher without a steeple, without a Genevan gown, who would step into churches where a pastor was absent. And he, Claude Williams, made the Bible a working man's book. Jesus the Carpenter. A rich man has much chance of getting toward heaven as a camel through a needle's eye. He spoke of the Bible as a working man's book, and one day wanders into a meeting with an old woman, an army blanket presiding. It's a tobacco picker's strike, all white in this instance. And he gets up and makes his speech to convince this woman, because he knew she controlled the congregation. And he speaks of the book, the Bible, the book, as a working man's book. And she gets up and says, first time I ever heard of the Bible and three square meals a day. And they followed his edict, his advice, and they won the strike. Now, if that woman in Girard, Kansas, who was the leader of the opposition, could have met Claude Williams, she could be converted. I'm convinced of that. People can change. If there's one thing that gets me, it's that.
Well, Studs, we have very little time, but I wanted to get your take on the current presidential race. Are you backing one of the candidates?
Well, I'm leaning toward, but I'd rather not say. Mm-hmm. All things being equal, which they're not, I can make a comic comment. It shouldn't be comic, but it is. I best like Dennis Kucinich ever since he was the boy mayor of Cleveland. Dennis says, bring him home now. He has a whole program. But of the candidates, obviously it's Clinton versus Obama, and I should not take a position on this. I do have ideas, but let that go for now.
Okay, well, one of the reasons Kucinich is not taken seriously is because he's not taken seriously, and you have less than kind words for the media. Do you think that they're responsible for fashioning these races in a way that a candidate like Kucinich doesn't have a chance?
Oh, of course. He never had a chance. Remember, he said each of the seven Democratic was asked to say, what would you pray for? And he said, I pray to be recognized, to be called upon. And he's very funny. But of course he's not a candidate. But it's either Obama or Clinton. I would lean toward, perhaps I shouldn't say it, Obama, but that is not the answer.
Well, he's the senator from your state. Maybe that's the reason you feel that way.
That's one of them. No, that's not the reason. The reason is we need a voice of somebody fresh who can say, not bring them on and challenge a world that science tells us can destroy itself. Can we destroy the rest of the world with a nuclear bomb? Of course we can. Can they destroy us? Of course they can. Science is universal. When Galileo discovered that the Earth is nothing but a star around the sun, did he steal it from, who was it again? The Polish Copernicus?
Mm-hmm.
100 years before? Of course not. There were spies, of course. What they stole were engineering secrets. Back in 1945, Princeton offered the Smythe Report that spoke of this. Science is universal. So we have a choice, really. Which way to go? Einstein's way or the way of primitives? And that's our choice as human beings.
Studs, it's been a pleasure talking with you again. And I hope that we can have another conversation sometime in the near future.
I'd like to very much, Leonard. Thank you very much.
And Studs Terkel's latest book is called Touch and Go, a memoir. It is published by the New Press. It also includes some excerpts from his spoken history classics, Hard Times, an Oral History of the Great Depression, and The Good War, an Oral History of World War II, plus conversations with his old friend and associate, Sidney Lewis. Thank you again, Studs.
Thank you.